Hi, everyone, and welcome to Book Hype, episode number 126. Today, we're going to be talking about The Dead House by Dawn Kurtagich. And my name is Karen, and I'm joined by Kristen and Brittany. Hi, ladies.
Hello.
Let's jump right into what we've been reading. Brittany, I want you to talk about yours.
So I read the Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them screenplay because I was really interested to see what made it into the screenplay, because I saw Fantastic Beasts a week early at a charity screening, and J.K. Rowling was saying how it was her first time writing a screenplay, and she was really interested in, like, getting all these new details in and stuff, and I talked about that last week, and now that I've read it, that didn't happen. So it was a little disappointing. There's not a lot of graphic, like, you know, descriptions of things that she said that she had originally in there. It's very much verbatim the movie. They didn't put any of the... There's one deleted scene that we know of, which is where the girls, Queenie and Tina, sing the Ilvermorny song. And I was excited because I'm like, oh, well, maybe that'll make it into the screenplay and I can read it and get that scene that they cut. And it's not in there. So they must have really made the book exactly... I've seen the movie 3 times. It is word for word the movie, and there's not a lot of descriptors in it. But it did clarify one major scene at the end that I had a lot of questions on, so it was a little bit helpful in that regard. But I'm still happy I have it. It's a beautiful cover. Oh, the cover is so pretty. I love it. And that was really a big selling point for me. But that's pretty much all I've read, because I'm... prepping for the Gilmore Girls premiere on the side, and I was reading Dead House, and I saw Fantastic Beasts 3 times, as I just said, so not a lot of spare time in my week. But I've got Lauren Graham's book coming, which I'm so excited about, and I just got Joe Buck's book in the mail, you know, one of the 7 people in the world who bought it. And I'm really, really excited to read it. I love Joe Buck, which is a very unpopular opinion in the sports world. But he's my favorite announcer, and I'm not ashamed.
You're cute. You said you've seen Fantastic Beasts 3 times. Did you really like it that much, or was it just like, oh, I'll go with you, sure,
even though I've already seen this? Well, the first time I went because of the charity thing that I bought tickets for a long time ago, mm-hmm. and then... I saw it again the day it came out to fact check an article that I was writing. And then I had tickets to go with a friend on Saturday. So, but I did really like it.
Cool. Yeah, we went too, Kristen and I, before I left to come home to New York. And it was really good. I quite enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun. I think I might take my mom, because she... really likes Harry Potter, the movies. Has she read the books? I'm pretty sure, yes, I forced her to read the books, and she liked them. Or else she wouldn't tell me if she didn't like them. But I think she'd really like it because of all the magic and all of the animals and stuff. Like, she would really find that cool. So I might go see it again.
Yeah, my sister was a late comer to the Harry Potter universe, but she read the books first, and she just went and saw it last night, and this morning was like, oh my gosh, I loved it. And my niece told her, Mom, you can go see it and tell me if it's too scary, because she's only 8. And aww. My sister is like, yeah, she can see it, it's fine, we're gonna take her. I'm like, okay, like, yay. So I'm geeked. And I may go see it myself this afternoon, I think. We have a free evening because there's no Once Upon a Time or Quantico. So I'm thinking, yes, I might just take myself to the movies later this evening.
Cool.
I mean, I could call people. I do know people, but, you know, it's also fun sometimes to just kind of go.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Sometimes the first movie I ever saw by myself was Mad Max, and it was like the best experience, and I felt so powerful. Like, that movie as a woman makes you feel powerful anyway, but like, it was so worth it. But anyway, Kristen, what did you read this week?
In addition to Deadhouse, which we read for today, the only book I actually started and finished, it was To Love and to Cherish by Lauren Lane. It's the last book in the Wedding Bells series, and it did not disappoint. For those that have read some of the other ones, this book is Logan and Alexis's book. Logan is an elbow patch wearing British man in New York who is just, oh my God, so freaking adorable. You basically fall in love with him in the beginning of the series, like in the first couple of books, because he keeps popping up. He's the accountant for the wedding planning business. Like, he's a silent partner and is kind of involved with it. So he is around all the time, and he's just so friggin' adorable and charming with his little accent, and yeah. But him and Alexis have this ridiculous, like, chemistry that they both kind of ignore and don't deal with, and the final book was really, really cute, and it was definitely a highlight of the series for me. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. It was a slow week for me.
Yeah, it was a bit slow for me, too. I started but have not finished reading Born a Crime by Trevor Noah, which is so incredible, you guys. Like, I'm only 2 hours into it, and I think it's like 8 or 10 hours long, but it is so good. He reads it himself, which was a big selling point for me, and it's about his time living in South Africa and the fact that as a person who's of mixed race, like his father was German and his mother is African, he was basically proof of illegal activities, and so he kind of had to hide the first, like, however many years of his life, and there was always sort of the stigma surrounding him where he wasn't really black enough, but he definitely wasn't white enough. And it's just these tales that he tells, and the kind of kid that he was and the way that he attacked life is so interesting. And like I said, I'm barely into it, but I like fell in love within the first chapter, and I'm so excited to finish it. And I hope that it continues on and tells us like how he came to America and how he transitioned, because he has a couple of stories where he's like blown away by the way that we live versus the way that he grew up. And I always like hearing those kinds of stories. So hopefully it continues on that track and we get a good slice. But yeah, I haven't even finished it yet, and I highly recommend it. I think it's awesome. Brittany, I think you would really like it too.
Yeah, it's on my list. I almost bought it last week, and then I, you know, had already ordered like 7 books. So I was like, okay, I need a break. So I'm going to wait for that one to come to the library.
That's probably a good idea. So for Book Bites this week, I thought we could just talk about our Thanksgiving plans, since I'm sure the three of us have some. Anything exciting you guys are doing?
Listen, Gilmore Girls is coming out at 3 a.m. the day after Thanksgiving. I am doing nothing else. I am spending Thanksgiving preparing. I am eating. I'm going to bed at 8 o'clock. I am getting up at 2:15. I am making a pot of coffee. I'm getting snacks, and I am watching Gilmore Girls straight through. Oh, that is my plan.
How long is it going to take you to watch all of them?
There's 4 90-minute episodes.
Okay.
So however long that is.
With 6 hours. So slightly longer than it will take you to watch an entire season of Sherlock.
Exactly. I am ready. I have never felt more prepared for anything in my life. So this is great. I'm so happy that it's happening on Black Friday, because I am always tempted to go out on Black Friday and just let down. Last year I worked in a retail store on Black Friday, so that was the worst Black Friday I've ever had. But I don't have to work. I don't have to do anything. That I'm so prepped, you guys. I'm so excited. I'm so excited.
Kristen, do you have Gilmore Girls plans?
I mean, there's a lot to fit in next weekend. Okay, here's my brief itinerary. I'm actually off work on Wednesday, and I'm hoping to take my niece to see Moana. I'm not sure if it's going to happen, but I really want to. Thursday, my sister is cooking for, I think, 26 people this year. Usually it's 10. So we're actually going, rather than going to her house like normal, we're going to her husband's parents' house. And we have a large crew appearing this year, so that'll be an adventure. After that, my brother and I usually hit Walmart for Black Friday stuff after dinner sometimes, so usually around like 9 or 10 once everybody's gone home and we're just bored. So we'll probably go hit up Walmart to buy discount Blu-rays and DVDs. And then, let's see, Friday, my mom and my sister and I always go Black Friday shopping, so we'll probably do that starting at about 5 a.m. And then I'll probably come home and take a nap and then go to work and then come back and then watch Gilmore Girls because I have to work on Saturday and the Ohio State Michigan game is on Saturday, and that is the big one of the biggest rivalries in college football, and it's intense and I'm not going to be able to watch it, but I can at least follow it while I'm at work. So next weekend's insane.
Oh yeah, and I'm also going to the Jets Patriots game on Sunday night, so prepping for that as well.
And there's two Lions games because there's a Lions game on Thanksgiving and then one on today, which is rough. So there's two Lions games this week, which is it's craziness, but good.
Well,
craziness.
I'm not gonna watch football, and I'm not gonna watch Gilmore Girls.
Oh, well, what are you gonna do? What else is there?
Let's see. So I'm back home. In quotation marks, this is my home now, but my best friend's mom and my mom moved in with each other, which is like the weirdest thing, but also kind of amazing. So I'm actually, my home is now my best friend's home. Like, she lives in New York City, but this is where we come. So we're going to have Thanksgiving here with my mom, me, my best friend, her girlfriend, her mom, her brother, his wife, and two kids. I think that's everyone. I hope that's everyone. That's a lot of people for me, which is hilarious because Kristen's going to a place with 26 people. So that's going to be an interesting Thanksgiving. Let's see how it goes. I have no idea, but at least I'll be hanging out with my best friends. And then probably going to do some Black Friday shopping. Definitely going to go see Moana at some point. Saturday is my 10-year high school reunion, so going to that. Yay.
That's exciting.
Sure.
Maybe.
We'll see how it goes. We're drinking before, during, and after it.
Yours will be better than mine was because at least you have friends going with you. I went expecting to see people that I just hadn't seen in a while, and none of them showed up, and it was all a bunch of people I barely ever talked to. So it was kind of lame.
I'm sorry, but yes, no, I do have a group of people that I'm going with, so that is, I mean, otherwise I don't think I would go, but we're gonna like sit in a huddle and be bitter together. It's gonna be great.
That's good.
But yeah, that's basically it, and then I shall return to Kristen at some point.
Oh yay next
week. It's nice coming home though, although I'm already stressed out, so
and she'll walk in the door and Christmas will have exploded and there will be music and she'll hate it, and that'll be great.
This is true, unfortunately, but I will try hard just for you, Kristen. You tried so hard for Halloween, and I appreciate that. So the least I can do is return that in kind. All right, let's talk about The Dead House by Dawn Kurtigich.
Halloween?
I'm very interested in jumping into this discussion. So, first off, Brittany, then Kristen, then me, buy or borrow?
I'm going to say borrow, but that's mainly because I'm not a huge horror fan, and I was reminded why I don't really like horror books. But I did actually kind of like this one, so definitely borrow for me.
Yes, I'm also going to say for me it's a borrow because I do not read horror. I do not watch horror. I do not horror. But the way it's written is really, really interesting and is really fun. And there's a lot of good about the book. I didn't like the subject matter, but that's just me. So if you like this kind of story, you will probably love this book because it is really interestingly done. But it's a borrow for me.
I'm going to go with bi because I think even though this is a horror book, there is a lot there to dive into. And it's very psychological. And if you're interested in the way that the human mind works and how people react to things, there's just a lot to dig through with this book. And I find that very fascinating. I did want to ask you guys, on a scale of 1 to 10, how scary you thought this book was, because I'm going to be completely honest, and this is like a 3 for me, which is really weird and maybe not great, because when I say that "and the trees crept in" is like a 9, I'm afraid that's going to dissuade you guys from actually reading that book, even though I really want you to. So, yeah, was this like super scary for you guys?
Okay.
Yeah. I was like, I want Kristen to answer this because we all read this in a different way and Kristen listened to it. So I'm really curious to hear what she has to say.
Yeah. Okay. So I listened to this book in the audio version, and it's incredibly well done. Like, it's a very well done audiobook. I've listened to a lot of them. So, you know, I spread it out throughout last week. I made myself listen to 2 hours of it a day at work, and then I finished it yesterday reading or doing the last 4 hours. It was a 10-hour book, and whatever. It's incredibly creepy to listen to. The way that they did some of the video dictation, like when there were videos in the story, they would tell you what you were seeing, like you would read it in the book, but they'd also put sounds in for things. So like when mirrors were smashing, you'd hear the mirror smash. When they're doing audio clips of someone like being interviewed, like the doctor, you would hear her chair moving when she was squirming around. They did this creepy music every time we entered the dead house. Every time Caitlin went to the dead house, you heard this like insanely creepy music start up behind her, and it got really loud as the scene progressed. And like, the audiobook is really, really well done, and it's really cool, especially because of the mixed media way this story is told. But it's incredibly terrifying.
I read it in regular book form, and I thought that that was also really well done. They used a lot of different fonts, and each page of the book looks like it was taped in there, and they wrinkled pages that were found under things. They put blood stains on different pages to show, like, you know, when mirrors were cut and she was writing, and yeah, the post-its and the chat transcriptions are all in here, and the video transcriptions each have creepy images at the top of the page. That didn't add anything to the horror for me, but I thought it was really well done descriptive-wise. I think I was more creeped out by the beginning of the book, because as like you're slowly diving into what makes Caitlin and Carly were really... That part was really interesting to me, and I have a huge fear of asylums. I don't like them. I don't like personality disorder things, and when it's done really well, then I know it's going to freak me out, and there were certainly moments. I was reading this in a Starbucks in New York City on Saturday, and it was getting really creepy, and I was like, okay, I'm going to go walk outside in the sunshine now for a little bit and take my head out of this. But yeah, it was creepy. So I'd give it maybe like a 5. I know that there are creepier things out there, and I just choose not to read them. And this is why.
Yeah, this, we've talked about it a little bit before, but this is ergodic fiction where it uses the placement of text on the page to convey a certain feeling, and it kind of messes with your psyche as you read it. And The House of Leaves is one, and The Trees Crept In, her other book, is another one. I read the e-copy, and maybe this is why I didn't find it as scary, because it was very bland. There were some instances where the text got a little bigger or smaller. There were some instances where the words were placed in a certain area on the page, which is really interesting. The documents were just written out, and it wasn't even necessarily in different font. So I was actually kind of disappointed with the e-copy. I thought that they would at least try to do some of that. There were some pictures in there that helped a little bit, but I think I'd really like to pick up the actual physical book sometime and read it again. And I'll talk about this later too. I'm very interested in reading this a second time for a lot of different reasons, but I would really like to have that tactile experience, I think, because a book like this, like, that's going to change the way that you interpret things, and being able to feel like you're actually going through the documents is a huge part of the story.
Yeah, and your next point about the jumping around in time, I was curious how that played out with listening to it and then also reading it in an ebook format, because especially the one time I found myself really flipping back and forth and making sure, like, I knew where I was in the story, like 35 days before the incident or 135 days after the incident. And then Scott, this is the part where I was like, oh, thank God I'm reading this, like, and I can flip back and forth very easily, was when they put Scott's interviews out of order. So they put the second part where he was, like, annoyed with repeating the same questions, and then they put the first interview, like, 30 or 40 pages later. So I was glad to have the physical book for that type of moment where I was like, oh wait, that's why he was so frustrated, is because it has already answered these questions. And why is this out of order? Like, what significance does that show? So I really liked having the physical book and being able to flip back and forth and then make sure I knew where I was at the start of each chapter. Cause some of them are like, there's no date and time associated with this video clip, or this part was redacted, or there's nothing here. And I think that having the physical book and being able to flip back and forth just to fact check yourself was really good too, because it kind of kept you in the story of being like, oh, you're unraveling this before it got into the more spiritual stuff towards the end.
I will say it was a little confusing with the jumping around. They told you the timestamp for everything as they were reading it. They had a female narrator doing Caitlin and Carly, and they both had different voices, and, you know, all the different characters kind of had different accents and voices. But they also had a male narrator who was doing all of the in-between stuff. So was telling you, this is an entry from her journal. This is an entry from... you know, this is footage from what's-her-face's camera. I cannot say her name.
Nah.
The way they said it in the book, or in the audiobook, Nadia, I forget how they said it. It had a really cool accent on it, and it was really awesome. But, like, when you were seeing her footage, they would tell you when it was time-stamped, like, you know, certain number of days before the incident or whatever. And with the redacting, anytime something was redacted, they gave you, like, that beep that you get on TV when people curse. So, like, for Brett's last name, they would say his first name and then beep his last name out. Or anytime that you had someone's name redacted or something like that, you would just get this beep in its place. So that was kind of strange. But once you figured out what was going on, it was like, oh, okay. They just... you know, erased the name, like, that makes sense. So, yeah,
I like the idea that they have two distinct voices for Caitlin and Carly, because I was finding myself sometimes being like, I don't know who this doctor is talking to, like, because everything is labeled as Carly in those transcripts, and then, yeah, like, you're reading it for a while, and then it's like, oh, no, but she's talking to Caitlin, because they, in the official hospital documents, they refuse to write her down as Caitlin. And so I kept getting lost a little bit, being like, oh, but is Carly back at some point? Like, when does she creep in? And so it was that part.
Yeah.
I was getting a little lost in sometimes.
Yeah. It was the same female narrator. Like, it was the same girl, but she did a very good job of giving Carly a very different voice from Caitlin's. So it was really easy to be like, okay, there was, like, one or two occasions where Caitlin had, like, taken over for Carly while she was with the doctor or whatever, mm-hmm. and it would take you just a second to catch up to it, but, like, within three or four words, you'd know, even before the doctor did, that it was Caitlin. You're like, oh, I know what just happened. So, yeah, it was that was definitely an advantage with the audiobook.
That's so interesting. That's so cool that they decided to do it that way. Now I want to read the audio or listen to the audiobook too. God, so much to do, so little time. I actually didn't have trouble with the difference between Carly and Caitlin. I don't know why. I can't really explain it, but I always kind of knew when it was Caitlin, even when it was during those periods where they were like, am I talking to Carly? Am I talking to Caitlin? I'm not sure. I guess it was just the way that, like, she was presented. Like, Caitlin has very different mannerisms than Carly. But the jumping around in time was definitely a little tricky. I didn't necessarily like that it was nonlinear. But at the same time, the fact that they tell you up front that something happened and they count down to it and then they kind of count back from after it happened and tell you, you know, show you those interviews and stuff, it definitely makes it more intriguing. And you're like, okay, I just need to get to this point in the story and find out what actually happened. But it did get a little confusing sometimes with some of the interviews where you were like, wait, when, at what point did this happen? Was it before this little event or this little event? Was it before or after the incident? So, yeah, but the whole idea of the sort of quote unquote found footage kind of document story makes it easy to shuffle those things around and present them in a certain order, and I think that's really interesting. Speaking of Carly and Caitlin, though, did you guys like one more than the other?
I had trouble with them because Carly, I felt, was more reliable, like more of a reliable narrator versus Caitlin, because Carly was being told that she was, like, the personality and that Caitlin was the dissociative one. She was the one that, like, was created. And so, for some reason, Carly just felt like, you know, despite their story being different from what the doctor told them, I more easily believed Carly than I did Caitlin. When Caitlin said things or when things were going on with her, I didn't know if I could trust her, especially at the beginning, and it got worse and worse as the book went on. And so I think I just had more trouble trusting Caitlin. It wasn't that I necessarily liked her less than Carly, but I had trouble figuring out what was the truth and what was her, you know, wishing that this wasn't the truth and all of that.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I had a really hard time trusting Caitlin as well, but I definitely think I liked her more. I felt Carly was really fake and almost like sedated the whole time. Anytime that we were reading about her, she was like, you know, I felt like she was like a product of medication. Like, you know, she was the one who could go to class and like have a like function, but we didn't get a lot of her. Like, this was very much Caitlin's story. And so I was more interested in Caitlin and her connection to Carly and wanting to protect Carly because she's so innocent and just is living her life. And, you know, I really just thought that Caitlin's character gave us a little bit more. Obviously she gave us everything that's in this book except for little post-its and stuff that were solely Carly's and then a few interview sessions, but even then it was mostly Caitlin that we got. And I thought that it was really interesting when they had that twist where it was like, oh, well, Carly's the one being suppressed, so she's the one who's going away, not Caitlin. And I didn't see that coming, which I thought was really, really cool on the book's part to play up that. So,
yeah, definitely. I completely agree with you about Carly. She's very passive compared to Caitlin. And she was always very bland to me. I don't necessarily blame, like, I don't think that's poor characterization. I think that that is Carly's personality because she was the one that kind of had to put forward their face and be the person that everyone interacted with. And so she was very reserved in a way that protected herself. And it was hard to, like, feel too strongly about her. Whereas Caitlin, I feel like you could either really like her or really dislike her because she was so decisive. She was so active in her pursuit of figuring out what was going on with them, you know, exploring the world for better, for worse. And she wasn't necessarily a great person, but I think she was at least honest with, you know, the face that she put forward. Whereas, yeah, Carly hid a lot of things, and she had to. I mean, again, that is to protect herself. But I'm really curious if you guys do believe that they were twin souls in one body, or if you really think that it was dissociative identity disorder.
I am of the twin souls side of this argument. Just based on, A, the fact that both of them and their little sister seem to remember them before the accident. Like, it wasn't like the little sister hinted that this had happened after. Like, it seems like she was very well adjusted to this and it had always been this way. So that kind of sealed it for me. That and the end of the book, at the very end, when you get Carly and Caitlin interacting one last time in the hereafter or whatever, wherever they are. And then the bit with Lansing, like, choosing to go into paranormal investigation rather than staying as a doctor of psychology and psychiatry. I feel like that gives it more of the paranormal side of all of this, like that there were two souls and that they both exist now and that they're both maybe present at the school like they weren't before. You know, they're both able to be in the same place at the same time. They don't have to take turns anymore. That's kind of how I thought this all ended. So I'm of twin souls side of things.
I am as well. There's this one line in the book where Caitlin says, "Remember when I asked you what the sun felt like?" And that was when they were five. And that's what really sealed the deal for me. This is something that's been going on forever. Unless that is a byproduct of the trauma where they are creating false memories of how they communicated beforehand. But I think that there's definitely something going on, and that plays into the larger, you know, mythology of this book, that the fact that there are these two souls. And like Kristen was saying, that final scene where they have that one last meeting, I thought that that really hinted at that as well.
Yeah, this is so interesting to me because I definitely fall on the side of twin souls as well. But then you really have to think about it and you have to go, okay, Caitlin is the subject of this book and Caitlin is also our narrator of sorts. We see much more through her eyes than we do Carly's. And you kind of have to wonder, you know, okay, is she an unreliable narrator? She's presenting her thoughts as truth, but that doesn't mean that they are truth. But I also agree, between some of the ending parts, and especially, like, I really feel like Dr. Lansing going into the paranormal kind of seals the deal for me. I think there's probably a way to argue the other side of that as well, that maybe she just ended up going crazy herself, considering everything that happened, but, and maybe like the guilt she was feeling. But that really kind of sealed it for me because she saw something supernatural when she went to visit the site of the incident and decided, okay, I don't need to be a psychiatrist anymore. Let's just go hunt ghosts. So
I did have a question for you guys about Carly. By the end of the book, from what we learned from her and from Caitlin about Carly and her friends, I was kind of the thought part that Carly was into girls and Caitlin was into guys. And so that's why Carly was so standoffish with Brett and with some of the others, but didn't really seem to have problems with the girls. And like, I wasn't sure if it was just something that came off like because of how it was being read, or if maybe you guys had like maybe felt that too.
I think it's stated pretty explicitly that she liked Nada. I'm just going to say Nada. I don't know how to pronounce her name, but that's the way
I'm avoiding names. Can you tell it's sad?
Yeah, she says, yes, maybe I do have feelings for her. Yes, maybe I do love her. And I think that was her way of hesitantly admitting that she had those feelings. So I was definitely under the assumption that she had feelings for her friend.
Okay. It was just something that had kind of, they kind of came out and said it, but then Caitlin had said that she loved her too. And it was just kind of confusing, but I thought it was an interesting way to again separate the two girls. Like, Caitlin was very much into Ari and into John, and Carly was definitely more into Nida or whomever, whatever her name is. So I thought that was another way to kind of differentiate the fact that these may not just be personalities, these may be different people.
Yeah, and we got that exchange between them when she, like, pulled some old journal entries or their burn book entries where she said, like, where she accidentally revealed the John thing. We got to read that, and Carly's response is like, oh my god, are you dating him? At like, what is going on? She's like very nervous about what's been going on when she's not around and what's happening to her body when she's not around, and it's probably something that she's just not comfortable with. And I thought that that whole exchange was really interesting in the way, I'm glad we got to see that exchange because it really plays into what one is comfortable with, the other one might not be, and they are really trying to hone in and pay attention to each other.
Another sort of character, another sort of side to them was the Dead House, which is obviously the name of the book as well. I was, for one, a little surprised that it took this long for the Dead House to show up, because I was trying to figure out, you know, the connection between that and the title, and it just felt like it was a ways until that kind of came into being. But we find out that it's actually their self, their mind, I guess, their being as a physical construction within her mind. And we meet a whole bunch of things within the house. And the first one is the snake, the Olin that was possessing Carly's body, which Nada defeated. And that was really interesting. And that also came right before Nada cut her tongue off, which was the single most scariest part of the book for me. I don't know about you guys. Maybe not.
I'm trying to think. I'm like, was that the scariest part?
It's the only part that made me have a physical reaction to the book.
Yeah, it was definitely unexpected and incredibly creepy. And I definitely didn't understand it when it was happening. I'm not entirely sure I understand it now.
That was my question, because it took me a little while to just keep thinking about it, to figure out why, that maybe this was the price she had to pay, because she said she would do anything to save her friends. Maybe this was the price she had to pay to defeat the snake.
I assumed / thought that it was something having to do with, like, saying the name or something. Like, she wasn't allowed to speak, or she couldn't handle the evil that she had seen. And so her reaction of cutting out her tongue was like the spirit world's way of keeping her from ever speaking of it. It could have just been the price she had to pay, which makes total sense. But it just, in the moment, that was where my brain went, was that, like, she's not allowed to speak of it, so therefore she's not going to speak.
What do you think, Brittany?
I really lost touch with the book when we got to all of this stuff. So this is where I kind of was checking out. But I think Nada, whatever. Her name is...
I'm pretty sure it's Irish, because yeah, she had an Irish accent in the audiobook. And so it's like Naida, or like it has like that... Yeah, so we can just say Nada or whatever. Nada. But I think, like, with the accent, it comes out different.
Yeah, so this creature, the Olin, or whatever it was, I feel like Nada was so into finding her place in this thing that she lost touch of what the actual, like, you know, this is something I wrote down, and I'm having a hard time figuring it out. And it was how all of these people were drawn to each other. Like, you know how she says towards the end of the book, like, when they're all meeting in the basement, she's like, okay, you've all been initiated into this Mala religious type of ceremony thing, and you're all now parts of it. So I didn't know if that gave her the role that she had, and that it sort of was like a Neville Longbottom moment where I must defeat the snake. And wow, that was more accurately drawn than I was planning on going with it. all of a sudden I was like, oh, that's the vassal. Yeah, he actually did defeat a snake. But I was thinking more of like, this is my role because of like some sort of weird cosmic connection that I made through introducing all these people into this Mala. And like, this is where I'm predestined to go based on being inside the Dead House. Or was it something that she just, like, wanted to give herself this agency in there. So I would kept having this weird, like, I was torn between whether this was predestined or it was, like, forcing her themselves to be involved in it. And I'm coming more on the side of it being predestined because there's a lot of symbolism there with the tongue being removed because she's really the vocal point of getting all these people to connect. And without her being able to connect all these dots and speak between the worlds anymore, then it's sort of like, okay, now we are at this point and we have to figure it out on our own. And I don't know. It was just the whole weird unbroken mythology and like being able to like go into Carly and Caitlin's mind and it was actually a literal place, but then it wasn't. And then I was so taken out of the book. I'm like, this isn't what I signed up for when I was reading this. And I was on page 170 and I'm so into the book. And then now I'm like, I don't know what's going on. This is exactly a book that I wouldn't choose to read. Like everything just sort of, I felt like they were trying to cram too much into it at the end. And I just was wanting to get it over with and get to the final end of the book.
Yeah. As far as like Nada's, like her role in like what she took on as her role, I always thought it was just because she was like the main practitioner of all of this. Like she was the person who actually understood Mala. The rest of them were a part of like her circle, but it was because she wanted them there. It wasn't like they all practiced it and knew what was going on. So I just assumed that she had taken on the role of Caitlin's protector and Carly's, you know, hopeful savior at the time. Just because she was the one who understood it and that it wasn't necessarily something she had to do, but because she cared about Carly and because she wanted to bring her back and wanted to help Caitlin, she had taken on all of this, and that was why when they walked into the dead house together, she took on the role of snake killer because, you know, she didn't think it needed to be Caitlin. Like, I think she felt like she needed to be the one to do the saving.
Yeah, and then there was, like, that whole, she's very in tune with what's going on with Caitlin and Carly, which I thought was interesting how her character shifted towards the end, like, where she was really protective of Carly until she realized that she also cared for Caitlin because the beginning scenes were very much Caitlin versus Nadia. So it was more like, you know, they're butting heads. Caitlin's very aggressive with her. And then they sort of, once Caitlin was around a lot more and she saw Caitlin looking at her, like, you know, practicing through the window, like, their relationship changed, and then there was the whole Halloween catastrophe. So I'm really interested in, like, plus, oh, the camera thing. So she is also trying to document all of this, and I think she's just really interested in what it is doing for her practicing. Like, you know, she's practicing this Mala, and to have an actual case study I think would be incredibly interesting for her, even if she like abandoned her sociology project in order to follow this. I forgot all about that. So sorry, I'm processing this new revelation in my head on air. I'll come back to it.
I think the idea of it being sort of a cosmic thing is really interesting. Although I agree with Kristen that I feel like she felt she was the one who could do this the best. She had the most knowledge, the most power, and it was sort of her role. Although the idea that, like, the Viking came back and all these people ended up in this place surrounding Caitlin is very interesting. And the way that people popped up in pairs to have an argument and stuff, it, like, I don't want to say that it felt contrived because I really don't think that in terms of the book, but it feels like something else was definitely in play here. And I think that that kind of makes sense given that you're talking about spiritual things and demons and, you know, maybe even gods and goddesses pulling strings. So who knows? But did you guys see that there's a novella that goes along with this book.
I saw it in the doc, and I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That link, and the title or the cover is terrifying.
Yeah.
Yes, it is a little bit. It's called The Dead House, Neda, a Companion Novel, and it reads... there is a box that should never have been discovered, and a warning beneath the lid. This was for Caitlin. It was a mistake. Forget this box and leave the aisle. Don't look any further. I'm begging you. NCD 2006. After the inferno that swept through Elmbridge High, claiming the lives of three teenagers and causing one student, Carly Johnson, to disappear, Neda Chunan Dupre was locked away for the good of society, but that wasn't the end of the story, because you can't play with the devil and not pay the price. The chilling psychological horror of the Dead House returns with never-before-seen footage of the Neda tapes.
It is 448 pages. How is that a novella?
Good lord.
I just kept scrolling, and I was like, oh my gosh, that is not a novella.
Yeah. I'm reading this. I don't know about you guys, but this is really interesting, especially because we get some of the tapes that they couldn't find during this story. Yeah.
How about you just tell me if there's anything I need to know? Because I don't know if I can get through that. I don't have a big problem with, like, thriller, like, slasher movie kind of horror. Like, I can handle that. It's the demon, devil, like, other world evil stuff that I can't handle. Like, it's so creepy that I can't do it. And knowing that that's kind of where this is going, I don't think I could get through it.
Yeah. Oh,
like, this book was interesting enough because of the DID stuff and the different souls stuff. Like, that had a totally different thing going on, rather than the actual, like, demon possession, which we got into by the end of the book, you know? So it's a little different.
Yeah. I definitely will not be reading this because it plays into more of where I didn't like this book, and it isn't 448 pages. That is information for The Dead House. But, because it says that this title is not currently available for purchase, so I don't know. I don't know where to get this little guy.
Yeah, it should be up now. The author tweeted about it, but for some reason, maybe it's just taking a little longer to load. But I'll read it. I'll let you guys know what I think. I'll let you know if there's any revelations.
It's available in hardcover and paperback. It's just not available on Kindle.
Which is hilarious, because this is supposed to be a digital short story.
Yeah, I think because I clicked on, like, the preview, and it gave me the Dead House.
Oh, wait. Yeah, it took me to Dead House. Yeah, that's weird. Okay, yeah. Never mind.
It'll be there eventually.
We'll figure it out. Yeah. So going back to the Dead House, the actual thing in Caitlin's mind, we also find out that she was possessed by a demon. And I'm assuming that this is Akamana, because in the beginning of the story, Lansing says that he's from Zoroastrian mythology and was associated with evil thought. He was the kind of demon known to affect the mind. And we know by the end that she is possessed by a demon, or at least that's what Ari tells her. So that was, I mean, to be possessed by two things at once, like, no wonder things were going crazy around her.
Yeah, seriously. Akamon was really terrifying, because it was, even as I was reading it, the whispering and breathing parts, like, creep me out. Or when she sees the girl, I can't handle that. Like, the broad daylight, if you look in the corner, you can see someone looking at you. I can't handle that
type of God.
Stuff. So.
That little girl's voice. Oh my God. Like, just little and creepy.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No, we're done.
Couldn't do it. Like, it was making me nuts. Yeah.
Did you have the breathing and stuff too, Kristen?
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Oh yeah.
Oh, my God.
When she's, like, talking about someone being behind her, like, they would take a second in between her lines to kind of just let you hear, like...
Nope.
No.
Like... Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah. Oh,
nope.
Yeah.
Shut it down.
That would have creeped me out so much more.
Well, and again, like, they put in, like, sound effects to make you feel like you were in the videos or you were in the audio clips. So there was more to it than just, like, what you could see on the page or read on the page. And that is what just, yeah, maybe that's why it was so hard for me.
Yeah, I don't blame you at all, actually. And the last part about Carly and Caitlin is also that Nada said that they were a portal to somewhere else, that there was a portal in their mind, which is, I assume, where Carly was taken and Akamana kind of... First of all, I just want to say that one line where she says, she heard him shouting from far away, whispering when he's close, and now that he's silent, she assumes that he's there with her all the time. I was like, whoa. That's terrifying. Yeah. But this portal or something, like, I didn't really understand what Nada meant by that, and I didn't really understand the consequences of having that in her mind. I mean, does that mean she's more susceptible to things coming in and out of her body?
I think the portal was opened, okay, by Carly, who started messing with stuff she didn't understand. And it made them more susceptible, yes. I don't think they were born with it. Before any of this started, I think it was, you know, like, her mind was her mind. Like, Caitlin's mind was her own mind, like it always had been. But because of the stuff Carly did, it messed with Caitlin. Kind of like when Carly took meds, Caitlin was affected by them more than Carly was. And, like, that sort of stuff. I think it's the same thing here, is because of what Carly was doing in the daylight, Caitlin's world was thrown into, like, chaos. And so that's where the portal and her having to deal with the demon comes in and all of that.
Yeah, I think that she's been used too many times as well. And so now she's just, her body and soul are just so open to any of these type of spiritual connections. And if she's just in the vicinity, it's just like, you know, and I think that that's what really drove the ending of the story, where you didn't know who was there. You didn't know if Carly was there. You didn't know if Caitlin was there. You didn't know if Akman was there, who was speaking at any given time and who was, like, you know, crossing things out. The biggest thing that got me towards the end was where certain things were underlined in her diary, Caitlin's diary entries, because there was this one passage, it's like maybe a, I don't know, like 70 pages from the end or whatever, but she underlines every time different people said something. So it's like not a said or she said, and she underlines the word said or says in every single one. And it was really interesting. I don't know if that was someone trying to, like, what type of person was inhabiting her at that time, or if someone was going back and editing it, or if that was the police editing it, being like, okay, these are statements that we need to take down. Like, I don't know who was there, but it opened up this idea of, like, these portals and, like, who's inhabiting who opened up this whole idea of, like, I don't know who's reading this at any given time or who's going back and who's crossing out things. And it's really interesting and probably something that should have been paid attention to, but I only started picking up on it like 350 pages into the book. Whoops.
Speaking of the medication and all of that, though, let's talk about Dr. Lansing a little bit, because I want to know if you guys think she actually did the best she could do for Carly. Do you think there was any malpractice there? Do you think there was neglect? Because during her interrogation, the officer certainly blames her for everything that was happening. Of course, later we find out that her license was taken away too. Do you ever feel bad for her, or do you think that's totally called for?
I liked her in the beginning. I thought she was doing great work. And then when it got to the scene where the police were interrogating her and they're like, do you think they listed everything that Carly was on, like, medication-wise, and she was defending it? And the defense I didn't have a problem with, but the fact that she was saying that she was under-medicated at that point was very alarming. And then towards the end, she just, I felt like she became so passive in her, like, sessions before Caitlin broke out. I feel like she was just, like, really pushed. Like, she just became so docile and very just like, oh, you're making great progress. And I'm like, no, you're not fighting back hard enough against this. Like, you're seeing the results you want to see. And there was something that really bugged me about her final sessions with Caitlin, where she's like, great, you're accepting that you're Caitlin and we're moving on and things are getting better. And I was like, no, you have to fight back at her. Like, you can't just sit there and let all of her answers wash over you. I felt like she wasn't as invested anymore. And so I felt worse for her in the beginning than I did at the end.
I think I was kind of the opposite. I was just like Caitlin, and I basically hated Dr. Lansing and, like, blamed her for Caitlin not feeling like she had her equal place. Like, because the doctor is trying to put a scientific spin on it and make it DID and not the two soul problem we've got going on, I totally was on Caitlin's side. And then as we got into Dr. Lansing, like, as she got further and further into the case, I started to kind of feel badly because, you know, as far as she knows, as far as science knows, you can't have two souls in one body. Like, it's just not a thing. Of course she would try to diagnose it as DID. Of course she would try to treat it as best she could. And when you've got science going up against something paranormal like this, it doesn't necessarily end well. And for her trying desperately to help Carly put Caitlin away, only to have Caitlin step forward, which is something that had never happened, like, really before. She talks about it being incredibly rare. And then her trying to, like, accept that Caitlin is the, you know, the original identity for this person, and that she now has to help her, like, deal with getting, you know, with Carly disappearing. It just, there's so much working against Dr. Lansing in this book that I, by the end, felt really badly for her and was glad that in the end she ended up stepping away from psychiatry and was like, this is more interesting and I was wrong and now I want to know what was really going on with these girls, and, like, is now looking into the paranormal of it all.
Yeah, I'm going to have to agree with Kristen on this one. I was really annoyed with her in the beginning. I thought that she was not necessarily her fault, but I thought she was ignorant because it was very clear that, maybe not very clear, but I definitely fell in line with Caitlin thinking that there were two souls in one body. And I was like, okay, she's just trying to name something that would make sense with the symptoms that she sees in front of her. Not her fault. That's her job. She's just wrong, plain and simple. And you're really annoyed that she's not necessarily listening to Carly and Caitlin in the beginning. And as the story goes along, I started feeling bad for her because I was like, there's no way this lady would truly understand the depth of problem that Caitlin has here. And the way that the officer was, you know, using her, I think, as a scapegoat was really sad. I don't necessarily know whether or not I agree if she was being over-medicated or if Lansing did something wrong. Maybe she did do something wrong, but I think she thought she was doing the best thing. And not in a manipulative, vindictive, like, evil genius kind of way, but she literally was just trying to do what she could with the information that she had. And she didn't have the full story, so if something went wrong, like, I was unsurprised.
I think that's almost just saying exactly the way I feel about her. I'm interested in how you guys didn't, like, it's interesting that we both brought up the same points but have different feelings. You know what I mean? The way she was treating Caitlin and Carly was what she was doing to the best of her ability for her job at the time in the beginning, but we both took it different ways. I just think that's interesting. I'm not arguing it. I thought that was a really cool way that you guys, we both said the same thing, but took it very differently.
This book is like that because it's so layered and complex. Yeah. There's so many interpretations that I think that's another reason why I liked it, is because, like I said at the beginning, there's so much to dig through, and just talking about it here, it's like, yeah, we're presented with literally the same evidence. This book is nothing but evidence, and yet we're interpreting it different ways and coming to different conclusions and have different feelings about it. It's very interesting. But I do want to talk about the fact that she lost her license and is now a paranormal investigator. This only happened after she visited Elmbridge, and we know from the end of the book that 26 people have gone missing here and that people hear girls whispering in the basement. What do you think happened there to change her mind so dramatically?
I think she got to talk to Caitlin and Carly at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I think she met both girls, and meeting two spirits, talking to two spirits in one place who she completely believed were DID, it just, she couldn't believe medicine anymore. And she couldn't trust that she couldn't make that mistake again. And so she decided that her time would be better spent, like, learning about these girls and seeing what they went through and all of the paranormal aspect of that. That was kind of where my brain went.
Yeah, I think I agree with that completely. She saw the limit of science be surpassed in that moment. And so, like, how can you go back to trying to prescribe medications that's going to suppress this type of thing that's going on in someone's mind when now she realizes that it's something bigger than than just being able to say, oh, it's DID, and prescribe medication and talk about it. It's something more, it's something beyond the limits of medicine. So she has to do something about it, and she has a perfect case study to kick it off.
Yeah, really. So let's talk about D for a little bit. Because this is one of the parts that I feel like I don't really know the answer to it. And I'm still a little confused about all of this. Because at first, she starts writing in a diary. This is not a diary that she shares with Carly. This is all her own. And she, instead of saying Dear Diary, she calls her D. And at first, it's a construct to feel less lonely, because at this point, she and Carly are sort of at odds. They're not talking as much, and she feels like she has things happening inside of her that Carly might not understand. And later, it appears as though the diary seems to manifest, whether that is physically or only in her mind. I really don't know. I guess my first question is the half-dead girl supposed to be the diary?
I want to say yes, because the way that the girl was laughing at her, I think that the only way that you could have this person teasing someone else is if they're privy to these thoughts, and if she's not, whether or not she's thinking obviously you're thinking everything you're writing, because that's how brains work. It has to be in your head before it's on the paper. But I think that she created this manifestation of D in the way that she's like, okay, I'm going to pour everything into this, but I need a reaction to it. And the reaction is this person looking at her and kind of stalking her and knowing everything that's going on and like mocking her a little bit to the point that it's pushing her. And I don't know. I think that is the reaction that she was looking for, to be like, okay, yeah, you are crazy and you're driving yourself insane, and having that manifestation of D be the person who's freaking her out I thought was really interesting. And I was all for D being the creepy half-dead girl.
Yeah, it's completely in her head. I think the manifestation is in her head, but I definitely think that it was D. Like, it was supposed to be her. Just, like, at the beginning, the half-dead girl is so creepy, and Caitlin is terrified of her and doesn't really know. But by the end, you see that the half-dead girl, calling her the half-dead girl is scary enough, because you're like, what? Like, how do you even picture that? Like, ugh. But, like, as the book went on, we found out that this half-dead girl was trying to help her, and that all along was, like, pointing at things and pointing things out to her that she may not have seen. Like, the scene that sticks out in my head is with Dr. Lansing, when she finally, like, makes the break and gets out of there. Like, the half-dead girl is the one who, like, signals to her that something is terribly wrong, and that's when Caitlin's like, I have to leave. So, yeah, I definitely think it's D. I definitely did not know that as the book went on. Like, I thought she was a manifestation of the Akamana or something. Like, I thought she was a part of all of that until we started to learn that she was helping her, and then it all kind of clicked.
Yeah, it's so interesting how she was initially presented because, well, first of all, we do get Caitlin describing what she thinks D would look like, and the way that she has two different colored eyes and her hair, like, that all lines up with the half-dead girl. But at the same time, the first time we meet her, really meet her, she comes through the mirror and she tries to choke Caitlin. And that is really interesting. I don't know if that's like a get out of here kind of warning, but it immediately puts her on the other side. Like you said, for a little while, I was like, oh my God, could this be the Akamana sending this person after her? You kind of don't really know. But as the story goes on, it becomes more real. And Caitlin begins to not only talk to Dee, but converse with her like Dee is talking back. And I was wondering, like, you were saying you definitely think it's something that's just inside her head. And I kind of think the same thing, you know, this is just a sign of her psychosis. But at the same time, with all of this Mala stuff going around, what's to say that this thing isn't real, that it hasn't manifested in some way?
It's definitely a possibility. I mean, there's a whole lot of crazy, like, different worlds and levels of evil, and there's a lot going on in Caitlin's head. So there is every reason to believe that by the end, Dee actually had some sort of physical presence. I would not have been floored to actually, like, you know, get solid proof that she was physically there.
Yeah. And I think the fact that Dee shows Caitlin clues can go both ways too, because if these were things that, like, Carly finding Carly's diary, if these were things that Caitlin already knew because Carly knew them and that information was in her subconscious, it would make sense that the diary as a form of her subconscious could point her in the right direction.
That's interesting. Ah, this book.
it's so complicated, and I think there are so many different interpretations, because I can even see an argument for D actually, or for the half-dead girl actually being Carly, because talking to the diary is like talking to Carly, and if they're both within this her head, you know, like, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole too much, but I could probably find a way to argue that maybe it was a form of Carly as well. Because, I mean, at least throughout the book, Caitlin definitely wonders if it's hers, if it's her too.
Well, and I, once we kind of saw that Dee slash the half-dead girl was helping her and wasn't necessarily out to hurt her, wasn't a part of the Akamana stuff, I wondered if it could be Carly or some version of Carly that was finding a way to point Caitlin in the right direction to try and save her. I didn't know how that was happening, but it was an option in my brain at the time. So who knows?
Yeah, at one point, I think the mirror thing was really like when she would look and see the dead girl. It was like, oh, well, Carly is dying. So is it really Carly? Mm-hmm. And, you know, is this what Carly has become? And then she starts to feel all this racking guilt over the fact that that is the version of Carly that she is now created by trying, by, like, actually, you know, integrating. And so then she's like racked with, you know, oh, I'm still always looking for Carly, but Carly's half watching me. It's open to so much interpretation, and it's really confusing. And now I'm lost again.
Sorry. Well, let's move on to something maybe a little bit easier to understand, or at least something with fewer layers. And that's Ari, because he claims that he loved Caitlin and he wanted just her, not Carly, and that he also harbored an Olin inside, which allowed him to do everything that he did. My question was just, like, why was he so obsessed? I feel like that was the one part of the book, and even with the other guys, like with Brett and stuff, I feel like that was the one part of the book that wasn't really, it didn't lay out enough evidence for it. It wasn't about interpretation. It was just like, okay, all of a sudden this guy is so obsessed with Caitlin that even before they started hooking up, he was already doing things to make sure that she was his all to himself.
Yeah, the guys of this book were so flat for me. Ugh, I was so annoyed by all of them, especially Brett, name redacted. God, he was the worst. When they made him cut off his pretty perfect blonde hair, though, that was hilarious.
I laughed. Yeah.
He's like, I have nothing to contribute. And they're like, a lock of your pretty hair that you care way too much about would be fine.
And I think Scott said that, which made me laugh even harder.
Yeah. And, but yeah, Ari, I thought that he was, I don't know if this sounds weird. Well, this is a weird book, but I thought that he was too convenient to have another, like, random guy in a bowler hat stalking around and just, like, creating this safe space for her. I didn't really like his character that much. I thought he was a little, like I said, like, just convenient. I liked that she did have a sounding board, though, and someone that she felt that she could tell her secret to besides, we're back to her name, Nada, or, you know, trying to explain it to Scott or trying to explain it to Brett, name redacted. So I don't know. He was good in that respect, but then he just started to annoy me. Like, once they hooked up and got together, I was like, all right, he's got to go, 'cause he's driving me insane. That we had, like, that whole weird jealousy thing with Brett in the basement. I was like, oh my, how are you trying to squeeze this in right now? Seriously, there's so much going on, and demon possession, and we have to go into a dead house. Someone's about to get their tongue cut off, and you're going to throw this at me? I can't handle it.
Like, can the boys just keep it in their pants? We've got enough going on. We don't need anybody else throwing, like, I get jealousy that, into the mix.
I get that the crazy is, like, a really attractive feature, but I just, we need to take a breath and figure out what's going on here.
As far as, like, Ari, like, being the bad guy, I really didn't, sadly enough, didn't see it coming. I thought it was the Viking. Because, like, before we met Ari, she was already talking to Dr. Lansing about the Akamana and the voices. Like, we hadn't even met him yet. And so I had thought that maybe this was something that had started before she came to school. Like, that was the connection in my brain. By the time we were starting to try and figure out who was doing this, like, by the time we were looking at people around her saying, somebody's doing this, my thoughts went to, it has to be the Viking. It has to be Mike, because he's John's the only one.
The Viking.
Whichever. Oh, I'm so bad with the boys. God. Okay,
yeah, Mike
John.
Mike was the one who, like, the original, like, mirror breaker guy.
Oh, the one she cut up. Book.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, John. Yes, my bad. My bad. The Viking, John. I really thought it was him, just because he was the only one she knew before she came to school. Like, he was the only one that had that connection to her. So since we'd started seeing this, at, you know, when she was talking to Dr. Lansing, might have also been an issue of me with the audiobook not being able to double check timelines, because if she was talking to Dr. Lansing and she had been at the school and, like, Ari had been around her even though she hadn't met him yet, like, I wasn't able to go back and check that. I wasn't able to, like, look at where she was talking to Dr. Lansing and what exactly had gone on before then. So I originally had thought it was John was the Viking, but, you know, I wasn't surprised it was Ari. By the time we got there, it made sense.
One thing I did like about John in these moments in contrast with Ari was the fact that he was pushing her to go back and get help. And I thought that Ari would get there first. So when he didn't, that's when I was, like, kind of tipped off, like, okay, this guy, first of all, who wears a bowler hat? Second of all, he's a little, like, weird. I kept thinking of Meet the Robinsons, because they call him the guy in the bowler hat is the villain the whole movie. And so I was like, oh, the guy in the bowler hat.
I kept thinking of Cornelius Fudge.
Yeah, me too.
Like, the whole time. Like, I was, like, picturing a lime green bowler hat, and I'm like, this is just not right.
But yeah, I really thought that what John was pushing Caitlin and Carly to do, Ari would have been the one to get there. But I liked having this outsider kind of come in, and it showed a different side of, like, oh, well, there's other people who actually care about her on the, you know, the outside. Plus, he had a lot of information, which I thought was interesting as well for his character. I didn't think we'd actually ever see him. And when they actually, when they brought John in to talk to her on the phone the first time, I thought it was a doctor playing John. And I was, like, not convinced that he actually called. I was so unconvinced about that. But then I realized, I'm like, oh, but they would have, this is an official transcript from the mental hospital. Like, they would have put that in there, that it wasn't him. But yeah, if this hadn't been evidence, you know, like an actual document, then I would have written that until the end of the book. I would have been like, he's not real. It doesn't matter. He's not real. It doesn't matter.
I was suspicious of everybody, basically, and I didn't necessarily suspect that he was the bad guy all along, but I definitely didn't cross him off the list. And at one point, that's exactly what Caitlin does. She lists a whole bunch of people, and I think she leaves Scott and John uncrossed, but she crosses off Brett and Ari, and I was like, I think I literally said out loud to myself, creepy enough, don't cross them off just yet, because I was just like, I feel suspicious of everybody, and I feel like maybe they're all working together to drive this one girl insane. Maybe it's this elaborate hazing ritual or something. Like, this book has a tendency to make you very paranoid. Oh, but yeah. Did you guys feel bad when Ari died?
No.
No.
I felt really bad for John.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was the one guy in this book who actually, like, was looking out for other people. Like, he was trying to help Caitlin. He didn't know how to, but everything he said, like, he was trying to do good. And so in that moment, like, when he's clearly on to Ari somehow and was, like, choking him and she stabs him, I felt bad for her. I felt bad for John. Like, there was a lot going on in that moment that really got to me, like, in a different way than the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Because of exactly what Kristen said, that was the person who was trying to push her to be better. And in the only way he knew how. And he thought that the only way that she would get help would be to go back and be supervised and not be living in a basement, sleeping on a moldy mattress.
And shaving her head.
Yeah, it was a lot. There's so much going on.
Yeah.
I have to be the weirdo here and say that I kind of felt bad for Ari. Not because I liked him. I think it was more the fact that I knew that he was also possessed and he had also been messing with things that he shouldn't have been. And the fact that it all ended up like this was really tragic for everybody involved.
I have to say that with all of the death that happened all of a sudden, like, we had all of these kids and then out of nowhere, Juliet is basically dead and Haji's dead and Brett is dead and then John dies and you're like, what just happened? Like, everyone drops in a matter of, like, 5 chapters, and these chapters are not long to begin with. So, yeah, I think the character I cared the least about was Brett, and that's just because he was creepy and annoying. It totally makes sense that Ari he wasn't necessarily doing evil things. Like, he did care about Caitlin. So I totally see, like, feeling bad for him because he did care for her. Ultimately, he wasn't trying to hurt her in the long run. Like, he was trying to get her by herself so he could be with her. But yeah, he was definitely influenced by things that he probably shouldn't have been messing with. And it is kind of tragic. I just never really got a chance to be on his side of things. Like, I didn't really see things from his point of view like I did John and Caitlin.
That makes sense. I think the guys that I felt the least toward were either Mike or Scott, because they were very bland in my mind. And even though Scott was sort of around a lot, he was just, like, you know, white rice. Like, there was nothing too interesting about him other than the fact that he was dating Nada, which is, like, the only reason why he was around to begin with. So he didn't really serve a huge purpose for me. I will say that I really liked Haji even though he wasn't necessarily a good guy, he was very, very much a gray character, but he was at least proactive and interesting, and I was really upset when he died.
I didn't see him being dead until all of a sudden Caitlin was like, did Haji really go home? And I was like, wait, no, he can't be dead. Haji's smarter than all of you. Like,
right. That's
no
like
way.
When I lost hope is when Haji died. I was like, we're done for.
Yeah. I really thought he had just gone home. And so when all of a sudden Caitlin like pulls it out of nowhere, I was like, I didn't even think about that. Like, you know, yeah, if he's dead, we're really screwed. So, yeah, I liked Haji too.
Yeah, I really liked him. I liked when they first went to see him, and then when he came back and he, like, was willing to be there and help, I was like, oh, this guy, look at him. And then he died, and I was like, all right, great. Great. This is just fantastic.
Basically. All right, so final thoughts and questions. We talked about some of these already. I am curious if you guys think that when Carly and Caitlin's body died, if the demon was therefore defeated or if it had been released. And that is maybe also what's going on at Elmbridge.
That's interesting. I don't think it was defeated at all, by any means, because I think that we're supposed to be left wondering what will it do now, as opposed to like, oh, everything's fine and everyone can carry on. I think that, I'm because, as I said earlier in this podcast, I've seen Fantastic Beasts 3 times, the image of the final image of, like, just, you know, like, the blackness, like, floating all over the place is what I'm imagining kind of happening, and it's sort of, like, lingering around and trying to find what it needs to come back together again. So I don't necessarily think it's destroyed, but I think it's not whole right now.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. I like the idea that perhaps the demon has been released and Caitlin and Carly are there, because we know 26 people have disappeared, but not everybody that goes there disappears. So I'd like to think that maybe the demon gets some of them, but the girls are also there protecting people from them. And also maybe that's what's going on with Lansing too, and why she decided to go into the paranormal.
Yeah. Or like the girls are like sort of like ambassadors, like, you know, to purgatory or wherever they're living, like whatever state that they're in, sort of like if a demon or part of a demon or something sort of happens and these people are in need of some transition time, those Carly and Caitlin are the people to handle that and just like either push them on or make them comfortable with their new state of being, I guess.
Yeah. For some reason, maybe it's because, like, we're told about that image of Caitlin in the fire, like, with a smile on her face. And, by the way, creepy. I, in that moment, thought that maybe that was the defeat of, like, the Olin. Like, she was, because there are so many versions of evil going on with the Omen and the Akamana. I thought that maybe the Akamana was still present, maybe tied to a body. So, like, as people show up here and, like, as people investigate it and disappear, they disappear because of the Akamana and they die or whatever goes on there. I don't even know. But I do feel like the girls are part of why everybody that goes there doesn't disappear. I don't know exactly how it all works. But I feel like the smile on her face was because they won something. Like, I don't, as much as it creeps me out and the idea of that visual is really creepy, I didn't think she was smiling because the demon was making her smile. I thought it was because she and Carly, like, won something in that moment. Like, they might be dying, their body might be gone, but they're not, in the end, something evil was put down. I don't know which it was or if there is a way to know, but that's just kind of where my brain went.
That's also an excellent point. And I mean, like we've been saying, this book is so layered, and you can tell by the extra long book hype. This podcast usually doesn't go this long, but there's just so much to talk about. And the last sort of point that I want to make with this book in particular is that the ending is meant to be vague. And when I talked to Dawn, the author at New York Comic Con, she had this to say about The Dead House specifically, but also about And the Trees Crept In, her second book. "I believe in open endings. I trust my readers. When I first brought The Dead House into publishing, my agents and my editors were saying, 'Can we not have a more conclusive ending?' And it was something that I really had to say, like, this is not what I'm doing. I trust my readers. I need to trust them. They are people with minds. They think. They can work things out. Everything that they need is in the book, but I'm not going to decide for them what they think, because at the end of the day, it's a question of one side or the other. And readers always ask me, well, what is the answer? And I always reply, well, what do you think? Because I don't know. I might think something one day and something else another day. I do believe in not having all the answers, and that's kind of like life. And horror is about not having the answers. And The Trees Crept In, you do get all the answers. It's worth having all the answers, but not every time." So the end of this book is definitely open to interpretation.
Yeah, I think it would... I'm going to hit on something that you want to hit on, this, which is whether or not we would want to read it again. I think I would actually, in the right frame of mind, in broad daylight, only listening to it in, like, you know, when the sun is shining, I would like to listen to it and see if that changes anything for me. I think I loved reading the beginning of this book so much that I was even saying last night, I'm really liking it because... I liked everything. I liked the whole beginning of this book. I loved the first 250 pages. It was the ending that I was like, I don't know if it was because I had to finish it or I just, for something, some reason, the ending just did not click with me. I was very taken out of the book. I wasn't into it. I was like, oh, we're switching over to this. But I'd like to listen to it and get fully creeped out and then maybe start to unpack it differently and apply the ending to the beginning again. So yeah, I would definitely be interested in revisiting it because it is open-ended. Like, I don't have a set ending where I'm like, oh, well, I know the exact ending and what's going on, because there's still so many questions left that it does lend itself to another reread.
I really don't know.
I have a feeling that your answer is no, though, Kristen. Which I do not blame you for.
No, I kind of agree with Brittany in that I like the beginning of this book. I like the setup. I think where it kind of loses me is when you start having all of these different forms of paranormalness getting involved. Like, it's, if it was one force that they were fighting against, that would be one thing. But you've got the half-dead girl, who we think is Dee, but could be Carly, but could be something else. You've got the Akamana, then you've got the Olin, then you've got Ari, who was actually messing around in her head with the Olin. Like, there's so much going on that I had trouble keeping it all straight. And I think that caused me to have less of a connection to the end of the book than I did the beginning. I love the setup with the girls and them, like, figuring out the day to night stuff and trying to figure out a way for these two souls to live fully happy, fulfilling lives in the same body. Like, that alone was a really interesting premise for me. And I'd love to, like, I wish we could have gotten that story as... I don't think you can tell the two stories in the same book, but I really wish we could have seen them, you know, in their mid-20s working on, you know, Caitlin finding a way to have a life at night in the dark and feeling like a whole person, and Carly being able to be awake during the day and be a whole person and not just feel like they're halves of a whole. But because of all of this other stuff that was outside of Caitlin's control and, you know, that people were messing with her, it just, that took me out of it. So no, I can't say I'd ever really read it again, but there is a lot going on and a lot that I'm sure a second reread would help to clear a few things up here and there. And I think it's one of those books that if you listen to it first, reading it in the physical copy might be the answer to your problems, because you've got all of the sounds and the voices and the names in your head. And so now seeing it on paper might make it easier to sort through. And I think the opposite is probably also true. If you've seen it and you've sorted through all of it, to then hear it and put voices to these people and kind of see them moving around in your head as you listen, it probably will help you to see the whole story again too. So that may be where some of the answers lie, is like in multiple readings and really taking the time to dive fully into the story.
I completely agree with that. I think what I'm going to end up doing is reading Neda's novel. This is not a novella. It's a novel. Reading her story and then reading the physical copy of the book rather than the e-copy. And if, I don't know, I really fall in love with it, maybe also listen to the audiobook, because I feel like there is so much to interpret and there is so much to dig through that, like, you could read it a couple of different times and always come to different conclusions and always kind of see something that you didn't see before. So if we do that, we'll have to let our listeners know if anything changes. I would also like to know if you guys happen to read a sample chapter for And the Trees Crept In. There was one at the end of my e-copy. I doubt the audio version, but I don't know if there was one in the physical copy. But whether there was or wasn't, do you think you would read her second book?
No, because I don't like horror, and this was enough for me. And if you said that it's really creepy, then I don't think that I'm ever going to read it. Like, I still have nightmares about Goosebump books, so, I mean, I'm really not the target audience for horror writing.
If I give it a long time in between books, like, I couldn't read In the Trees Crept In right now, I'd probably give myself a heart attack. But if I next Halloween were to try and read And the Trees Crept In, because I want to kind of embrace the idea, maybe. You did kind of hint at a few things. I don't remember everything, but you did tell me a few things about that book. And knowing that there are, like, concrete answers at the end of it makes me possibly willing. I don't know. We'll have to see. I'm not a horror person, but there are times where I'll make exceptions. So she is... This book was very well written, and she is a very good writer, so that is not a part of it at all. It's literally just the horror of it all.
Yeah, exactly. It's not her. It's the horror. That's
yeah. I will say that with And the Trees Crept In, it is both scarier and more fulfilling than this book. It's very much on the fence whether you guys would like it. I like the idea, Kristen, of maybe waiting a while and then having you tackle it, because I really fell in love with that book. And it's the reason why I got so excited to talk to Dawn at New York Comic Con and why I really wanted to read this book. It is a very, very different book than this one. It is kind of on a whole different level. That's not to say better or worse. It's just different. So I'd be interested to see if you guys like it. But also, totally do not blame you, because there were points where I was reading it, then I'd, like, put my book down, look around a little bit. There's nothing in my room, right? Keep reading. So it does get a little creepy. All right. Well, that was enough of that. Thanks to everyone who stuck around to listen to this whole episode. It's quite long, but I guess that's a good thing, because next week we're actually going to be off. So no new episode of Book Hype next week. We kind of wanted a little time to collect ourselves, do the Thanksgiving thing, and hopefully get back on track for December. Our first week back in December, we'll be discussing some book news with you guys. There's been some interesting stuff going around. The following week, we're going to do a gift-giving guide for book lovers, and we're still trying to figure out how exactly we're going to break that down, but if you guys have any ideas, pass them along, and we'll see what we can do. Our author spotlight for the month of December is going to be Jane Austen. So I will finally read Pride and Prejudice, everybody. I will finally do it, but yes. I think that's going to be really exciting, so I'm excited to talk all things Jane Austen, not just her books, but the other things that kind of float around with it and her and all of that. There's a lot to dig through there.
Happy birthday, Jane Austen.
You're welcome. And then our book club book for December is going to be Dash and Lily's Book of Dares by Rachel Cohn. I don't know. And David Levithan? Levithan? I don't know.
Difficult to pronounce.
And this was Kristen's suggestion, so if you hate it, you can blame her.
Jeez, man.
I mean, they wrote Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist together, so it can't be bad.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of them, too, actually. They have another one. What's the other? I can't think of the other one. There's more, actually. Hold on. I just looked them up. So there's... Wait, which one are we doing? Oh, we're doing the Book of Dares, right?
Dash and Lily's Book of Dares comes before 12 Days of Dash and Lily, which just came out.
Okay, and that's like Christmas.
So we're doing the first book.
Okay.
So that everybody can...
Yeah, so we'll do the first book, and then everybody can read the 12 Days of Dash and Lily in the Christmas spirit.
Well, and Dash and Lily's kind of takes place at Christmas. It's got a little bit of Christmas in New York to it, so it kind of works for December.
Also, there's a typo on this website that says "but the book" instead of "buy the book." That's hilarious.
But the book. So yeah, that'll be a nice change from the Dead House for December, and much more appropriate for the holiday spirit. And we also have a little Secret Santa thing we're all going to do between each other, but we're still hammering out the details for that. So we're going to give you guys a heads up on what we're doing, probably when we come back, and then get that all in motion. But it should be fun, and it should see us reading things that maybe we wouldn't normally read. So that'll be, or we should have read a long time ago and haven't yet. But we'll come back with more details on that. But until next time, I'm Karen.
I'm Brittany.
And I'm Kristen.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.